How many adults use psychiatric medicines?
Does where you live influence how you die?
Do statins play any role in reducing Alzheimer's disease risk?
And an update on teen drug use.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 16th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn first to JAMA. This cause-specific mortality study, wow, this thing was absolutely huge and had some remarkable pictures, graphs that I'd like to refer everybody to. What are your thoughts on that study?
Well, Elizabeth, I agree with you. I think this was a fascinating study, and I'm going to encourage you to consider putting this on our blog this week.
I'll do that.
We know that there are geographic inequalities in terms of life expectancy, certainly among different counties within the United States. However, we really actually know very little about geographic patterns and these inequalities as pertains to specific causes of death. We've not really done a thorough analysis looking at the 21 most common causes in different counties across the United States and accounting for what I'm going to call garbage diagnosis. What that means is when somebody puts a cause of death as cardiopulmonary arrest, that really doesn't tell you what the underlying cause is. So what these investigators did was they used special analysis. They did more fine-tuning in terms of the statistics. And here's what they found. In looking at over 80 million deaths over a 35-year period in the United States, among over 3,000 different counties, they found there's a wide variation in causes of death. No great surprise. For example, cardiovascular disease mortality, highest along the southern half of the Mississippi River. When you look at self-harm and interpersonal violence, that happened to be higher in southwestern counties. And by the way, by looking at this over 35 years, they were also able to look at trends. So this is a tremendous database that will allow us to target specific diseases, will allow research to be conducted, and also to say how good are we at preventing diseases when we institute specific programs.
And clearly there are certain areas of the country where those very specific programs need to be employed. I was a bit chagrined, of course, to look at the really large amount of morbidity that's distributed along the southern half of the country.
Absolutely. It wouldn't be terribly surprising to also learn that that's also where the highest incidence of risk factors are, things like diabetes and hypertension, cigarette smoking, obesity, sedentary lifestyles. This is a very important and I think a very significant paper.
And it's got some really amazing graphics, so I definitely will utilize at least one of those and refer people there. Let's turn from here to JAMA Internal Medicine. This was a research letter, but I also found this one a little bit disconcerting. Gosh, how many U.S. adults are taking a medication that affects their cognition? Well, I'm going to say cognition, but let's call them psychiatric drugs.
And that's a fair characterization. As recently as 2011, about 11.5% of adults were taking some type of medication for, quote, problems with emotion, nerves, or mental health, end quote. And that data is a little bit dated. So these investigators looked at more recent data, asking what percentage of Americans are on some type of psychiatric drugs, what types are they, and then are there variations among the population? And what they discovered, after looking at data on over 37,000 individuals and over 357,000 prescription records, is that one of six U.S. adults reports taking a psychiatric drug at least once during 2013. And there were 2 to 3-fold differences according to race, ethnicity, age, and sex. Use of psychiatric medications much higher in white adults, about 21%, versus, for example, Hispanic adults, in which only 9%. It increased with age. About 1 in 4 adults over the age of 60 were taking psychiatric medications, and women were more likely than men. Antidepressants, about 12% of people across the United States. Sedatives or hypnotics, about 8%, and antipsychotic meds, about 2%.
I think points to this underlying level of mental illness that we really need to pay attention to.
Right, and so you might make the case, well, gosh, these are necessary medications. But also concerning is the fact that some of these medications are being used long-term when it's not recommended. For example, the benzodiazepines or hypnotics or sedatives, they're supposed to be used for short-term, but it looks like about 5% of adults are taking them on a long-term basis, which obviously has health implications.
Health implications and societal implications, because let's face it, those folks are also out there driving and doing other things that can endanger others.
And frequently combining them with other medications. And as we've talked before, they can be particularly problematic in the elderly.
Definitely something we need to get our arms around. Let's move from here then to another medication, one that I quip all the time. Wow, should we be putting this stuff in the water? That's statins. This is really a huge analysis in JAMA Neurology on the relationship between different statins and Alzheimer's disease risk.
The key there is Alzheimer's is characterized by having misfolded proteins in the brain. Things that cause inflammation are associated with an increased risk of Alzheimer's. And we know that statins, in addition to lowering cholesterol, have other properties. They tend to reduce stroke in mechanisms other than just lowering cholesterol. So the question is, do statins reduce the risk or the incidence of Alzheimer's disease? These individuals took a 20% sample of Medicare beneficiaries over a 7-year period from 2006 to 2013, and they compared the rates of Alzheimer's diagnosis among almost 400,000 statin users age 65 years or older. And they looked at different types of statins because some are more water soluble and some are more fat or lipid soluble. Those that are more fat or lipid soluble may have a better chance to cross what's called the blood-brain barrier and have a higher concentration in the brain. So here's what they discovered. Across all statin users, it appeared that the risk of Alzheimer's was lowered by about 15%. Things like simvastatin and atorvastatin were more likely to reduce Alzheimer's across both genders and all races. It didn't matter what statin used in African-American men, there didn't seem to be a reduced incidence of Alzheimer's with statin use. In general, women benefited from all the statins. I would say this is provocative, should spurn further studies, because what the authors suggest is, well, we may want to target different statins for different genders and different races, but what I'd say is that makes it much more complicated. We've talked before is that there are many people that should be on statins that aren't taking any statin at all. Instead of trying to make it so difficult to prescribe a statin, let's make sure that the right patients are on it to begin with.
I agree with that. On the other hand, I'm also a big fan of this personalized medicine approach. And so I think if you're a Hispanic man and it turns out that rosuvastatin is better for you, why not take that?
Well, these data are interesting, but obviously don't prove this hypothesis. Secondly, oftentimes these are limited by what kind of medication program you're on. And again, the most important use of these is in lowering cholesterol for primary and secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease.
And we're going to hear more about this, but congratulations to these folks for this amazingly robust database, I thought. Finally then, let's turn to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, a look at teen drug use and at least with cigarette smoking, good news.
Well, in fact, Elizabeth, across most illicit drugs, there's good news. When you look over the last 15 to 25 years, and this study looked specifically at 8th graders, 10th graders, and 12th graders, it looked like illicit drug use, with the exception of marijuana, decreased substantially across all three of those grades. Would you like to talk about specifics?
Sure, let's talk about the specifics.
The two things I'd like to highlight is cigarette use among teens has decreased substantially. Specifically, among those that would smoke half a pack or more, there's been a dramatic decrease in the incidence of cigarette smoking from about 10% to less than 2%. The flip side of that is e-cigarette use has gone up, but illicit use of heroin, cocaine, opioids has all decreased among teens. The downside is marijuana use still continues to be a significant issue among these individuals. It has decreased in some of these age groups, but not in all of them.
And with the legalization of marijuana in so many places in the U.S., this is going to be a really tough horse to get back in the barn, I think.
In fact, now that you mention it, when they looked at differences between states in which medical marijuana use is allowed or prohibited, those in which it's allowed had a higher incidence of use among teenagers as well. That's disconcerting.
It's very disconcerting because we know the data support the idea that, as we know, teenagers' brains are still developing, and exposure to marijuana or nicotine, for that matter, or any other aberrant substance is not good for their brain development.
Absolutely. It's compounded by the fact that there's also what's called synthetic marijuana, which is known as K2 or spice, and we know that that's associated with an increased incidence of death, particularly in adolescents and youngsters. But I'm happy to say that even that decreased from about 11% down to about 3.5% or 5%.
So I think this is really gratifying. It suggests to me that these kids are smart and they're paying attention. And I really like that particular outcome or interpretation of this study. So I think I'd like to stick with that one. What do you think?
I think this is important as well. And kudos to the programs over the last 15 to 25 years that have targeted adolescents in terms of decreasing illicit drug use.
I do have to just add the one public health caveat, though, about the vaping, and that is that I think teenagers need to pay attention to that, too, that exposure to nicotine for their developing brains, plus all the additives that are in those things, are not good.
Yeah, in fact, 2/3 of adolescents said they did vaping because of the additives. And again, that's disconcerting. That's a way the marketers are trying to get kids to use things that are particularly harmful to receive nicotine in ways that could be addictive.
Okay, so we're going to have this vote for their intelligence. Let's hope that they pay attention to the vaping as well. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.